Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunja Bihari. Gopi Jana Valabha Girivara Dhari. Gopi Jana Valabha Girivara Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunja Bihari. Gopi Jana Valabha Girivara Dhari. Gopi Jana Valabha Girivara Dhari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Yamuna Tira Vanachari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunja Bihari. Jaya Radha Madhava, Jaya Kunja Bihari. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jaya Kishore Kishore, Jaya Kishore Kishore, Jaya Kishore Kishore, Jaya Kishore Kishore. Jaya Jagannath, Jaya Jaya Jagannath, Jaya Jaya Baladev, Jaya Jaya Subhadra. Nitai Gaura Haribo, 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 Nitai Gaura Haribo. Jaya Jaya Prabhupada, 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 Jaya Jaya Prabhupada. Jaya Om Vishnu Padaya Paramahamsa Parivraka Acharya Asatara Sadah His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Jaya Om Vishnu Padaya Paramahamsa Parivraka Acharya Asatara Sadah His Divine Grace Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Goswami Prabhupada Ki Jai. Ananda Kauti Vaishnava Vrinda Ki Jai. Grantarat Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. All glories to the assembly of devotees. All glories to the assembly of devotees. All glories to the assembly of devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 14, entitled Brahma's Prayers to Lord Krishna, Verse 14. Nayanastvam nahi sarva dehinam Atmasi adhisakila loka sakshi Narayanon gam narabhut chalayanatat Tachapi satyam natavaiva maya Nayanastvam nahi sarva dehinam Atmasi adhisakila loka sakshi Narayana nargam narabhud jalayanat Tachapi satyam natavaiva maya One more time. Narayanastvam nahi sarva dehinam Atmasi adhisakila loka sakshi Narayanon gam narabhu jalayantnat Tachapi satyam natavaiva maya Narayanastvam nahi sarva dehinam Atmasi yatsasakila loka sakshi Jayanat Jayanat Achapi satyam natavaiva maya Ayanastvam nahi sarva dehinam Namasi adhisakila loka sakshi Vinayan gam narabhu jalayanat Tachapi satyam natavaiva maya Ayanastvam nahi sarva dehinam Atmasi adhisakila loka sakshi Ayanon gam narabhu jalayanat Achapi satyam natavaiva maya Thank you for chanting. We go to word by word translation. Narayanaha. The Supreme Lord Narayan. Tvam. You. Na. Not. He. Whether. Sarva. Of all. Dehinam. Embodied living beings. Atma. The super soul. Asi, you are Adisha, O Supreme Controller, Akila, of all, Loka, planets, Sakshi, the witness, Narayanaha, Lord Sri Narayan, Angam, the expanded plenary portion. Nara, from the Supreme Personality. Bhu, originating jala of the water, I am not. Because of being the manifesting source, Tat, that expansion, Cha, and Api, indeed, Satyam, true, Na, not, Tava, your, Eva, at all, Maya, illusory energy. Translation. And you are you not the original Narayan, a supreme controller, since you are the soul of every embodied being and the eternal witness of all created realms? Indeed, Lord Narayan is your expansion. And he is called Narayan because he is the generating source of the primeval water of the universe. He is real, not a product of your illusory Maya. Purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhakti Bhaktivinoda Swami Prabhupada. Yeah. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi Lila, chapter 2, text 30, Srila Prabhupada comments on this verse as follows. This statement was spoken by Lord Brahma in his prayers to Lord Krishna after the Lord defeated him by displaying his mystic powers. Brahma had tried to test Lord Krishna to see if he is really the Supreme Personality of Godhead playing as a cowherd boy. Brahma stole all the other boys and the cows from the pasturing grounds. But when he returned to the pastures, he saw that all the boys and cows were still there. But Lord Krishna had created them all again. When Brahma saw the mystic power of Krishna, of Lord Krishna, he admitted defeat and offered praise to the Lord, addressing him as the proprietor and seer of everything in the creation, and as the super soul who is within each and every living entity and is dear to all. Lord Krishna is Narayan, the father of Brahma, because Lord Krishna's plenary expansion, Garbhodakashayi Vishnu, after placing himself on the Garbha ocean, created Brahma from his own body. Mahavishnu in the casual ocean and Kshiradakashayi Vishnu, the super soul in everyone's heart, are also transcendental expansions of the Supreme Truth. In his commentary on this verse, Srila Sanatan Goswami has elaborately explained the expansion of the Vishnu or Narayan, incarnations from the original form of Godhead, Lord Shri Krishna. The essence is that although Lord Brahma was born from Lord Narayan, Brahma now understands the Narayan is himself a mere expansion of the original personality of Godhead, Lord Shri Krishna. Om Agyana Tirinandasya Agyananjaya Shakaya Chakshuvamitam Gena Tashmai Shri Devinna Shri Chaitanya Manam Vishnam Skapinam Vina Buddha Svayam Upakadamaya Dhanami Svapadantikam. Thank you everyone for coming and listening to the class, for chanting. Today's verse is continuation of Lord Brahma's prayers. As we have said, Lord Brahma came to a point of realization, of being ashamed, and he was willing to be disciplined. He offered nice prayers to Lord Krishna. He continues to offer prayers, and he has this realization that Krishna is the origin of even Narayan. There is a nice verse in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 3, Verse 28. Ate chamsha kalak pumsha Krishna stu bhagavam svayam. Indrari Vakyam Lokam Murdayanti Yuga Yuga. That Krishna is the original personality of Godhead. And all the other incarnations come from him. They're either portions of the plenary portions of the original Krishna. Srila Prabhupada says in the purport that Brahma wanted to test Krishna, but Brahma had to admit defeat. And if anyone can test Krishna, it would be Brahma, because he's the most intelligent being in the universe, so he has the best shot. But even the greatest of beings are baffled in their attempts. So what can we accomplish? What can we accomplish? All the living entities in this material world, it's for their benefit to admit Krishna's supremacy. Sometimes I think of this in terms of it's a psychological situation. To admit someone's superiority, and in my mind comes the figure of Srila Prabhupada, the figure of my Guru Maharaj. When I go back, the figure of my karate teacher, or any bona fide teacher who is represents a particular field of knowledge. So you have to admit someone is in a superior position. There is no harm, as long as they're bona fide, and then our ego is the only obstacle. Then we can learn, and then we're at peace. We're not struggling, that we're trying to be the best, you know, that no one's superior, you know. So it's a psychological thing. You just have to let the ego go. Easier said than done. I was trying to think of some examples to maybe describe it even better, or maybe you can use these examples. And obviously many of my examples come from the world of fitness, so that's my conditioning, and so if I give these examples, at least it's easier for me to understand. So maybe this example will be appropriate, maybe not, forgive me if it's not. So I'm thinking about martial arts, and there is a champion who reigns, you know, the reigning champion, and sometimes new warriors, new contenders come and try to take his belt away. They get a chance to take the title away. There's a big pre-fight conference interview. So people buy, you know, millions of tickets. Millions worth of tickets to watch that fight for a few minutes, how two fighters bash each other's brains out. Sometimes, so the champion is usually able to defend his title, maybe once, at least. And, you know, if the defeated fighter is somewhat mature, they will admit that, yes, the champion got the best of me, and I learned something, and I have to learn more. Maybe thank you for this opportunity to let me fight you, to let me try my skills against you. Thank you very much. I will try it again, maybe in the future when I improve. And sometimes the contender doesn't have a good state of consciousness, and sometimes he'll come up with excuses like, you know, maybe the referee didn't score everything right. Maybe the champion was not properly screened for stimulants. You know, he come up with different excuses that, you know, the fight was not fair. And sometimes when the champion is defeated, you know, he defends his title once or twice, and finally someone comes on board and defeats the champion. And if the champion is in the right state of consciousness, the champion will admit that it is time for him to retire, and that the new champion deserves to win. And he leaves the ring with, in a respectful way. So similarly, how I see this example, I see it that we tried so many times to test Krishna and test Maya, countless lifetimes. How many more times does Maya or Krishna have to show us that they are in a superior position, that it is in our best interest to serve Krishna? Let's put our ego, let's retire our ego, put it into a retirement. Also, I remember there is this nice example that I used to like, so I don't lose my determination. Chuck Norris would say, before you can throw others, you have to be thrown 100 times on the floor, and then you have to get up and keep fighting. But we have been kicked by Maya millions and millions of times, and we still don't learn. You know, how many times is enough? We still don't learn, and I'm talking in general about all conditioned souls, especially those who are outside of the Krishna consciousness movement. So in today's lecture, I would like to focus on different types of misconceptions we have about God, Krishna, and those obstacles, those misconceptions become obstacles in admitting Krishna's supremacy and embracing our spiritual practice fully, without any doubts. These misconceptions are of three types, and there are just three major ones, and there are many, many more. And these misconceptions make people, not only mostly people outside of the Krishna consciousness movement, but also many practicing devotees at certain levels, that we try to independently enjoy and test Krishna and belittle Krishna, put him in the back, somewhere in the back. So how to defeat those misconceptions within ourselves? So the first misconception that people have in general is that there is no God. God is not there at all. We cannot see him, therefore he's not there. And bad things are happening in the world, so for sure God is not there. So the question is, you can ask yourself or others, like, if God is not there, then how come you're here? How come anything else is here? Scientists have an explanation that there may be some explosion have happened and chemicals combined. But the chance of that happening is so close to zero that it's ridiculous. It's very, very close to zero. You're better off investing in a lottery ticket and winning millions of dollars. Also, the chance of a big explosion and how everything is created from chemicals by accident cannot be repeated, duplicated in a laboratory setting, so it's not scientific. If you can repeat something in a laboratory setting, then it's scientific and you can confirm your hypothesis. But if it happens once and you're trying to explain it, but you cannot repeat it, then it's not scientific. So there, just for starters, but our devotee scientists, like Sada Puttasa, Richard Thompson, they have published some books that explore those scientific fallacies that those scientists who are atheists try to explain how the world exists and came about without the necessity of God's existence. We take so many things on faith. We take even many scientific hypotheses on faith because there's not so much evidence, actually. Many pieces are missing, so we cannot definitely say that that's how things happen. But we take so many things on faith, so why not take God on faith? Assume that God is there, and once you get to that point that you philosophically accept that God is there, then things happen, and God will begin to reveal Himself to you. It takes time. Srila Prabhupada mentioned in many of his lectures that we have to be somewhat qualified to have some realization, to see God. If you don't believe in God, you know, you have a long way to go, then you have to, at least philosophically, I think Prabhupada states that in the introduction of Bhagavad Gita, at least philosophically accept that, okay, God is there, He's supreme, He's trying to teach us something. And then from that point on, you can progress in your realization. Is there God or there's no God? So this is the first misconception, that God is not there, and we're just here because of some big explosion. Everything is here because of the big explosion. The second misconception that I'd like to address is that God may be there, He's there, but He doesn't really care. He's not concerned so much. Maybe He's concerned about some things, like maybe some chosen people, maybe some saints, but not most of the people. Plus, so many good people are suffering, so it's not just. There's no justice, so maybe there's no God, He doesn't care. Or He got something wrong. First of all, suffering is subjective. It's a subjective experience. What may be suffering to me is not suffering to you. For example, I'll give you a funny example. Hopefully it's funny. From my work experience, many of my new clients who come into the door to get some physical therapy or some exercise, they were scared by their doctors. They listen, if you don't get in shape, if you don't lower your cholesterol or high blood pressure, you may die. So they get scared. But if they don't get scared by the doctor, they don't come and exercise. So it is to them, they dread exercise, any type of physical work. And they're out of shape and they're, everything else suffers. So they come to me and they have to, because the doctor push them here, and then they have to pay me, so I inflict some physical pain on them and I teach them how to exercise. So they're suffering, they don't like it, but for me it's quite different. I enjoy exercise, and I probably if I was not doing giving this class, I'll probably be at work and doing some exercise myself or my clients, but thanks to my Guru Maharaj, he's very merciful. He motivated me that I should do this, is try to do this service of giving lectures. So subjective, suffering is very subjective. What is suffering to me may not be suffering to you. Second of all, one may say that, sure, but there are some types of suffering that are kind of universal. You get in a car accident, you lose your arm, or your house is burned down. You don't like it. No, nobody likes it. So some things you have to agree that are, it's like common denominator, that we all suffer at one level. The scriptures agree that it is actually true. It's not very natural for us to suffer. It's not, because that's why we don't like it. And it is explained in the scriptures that this world is a type of a prison house, and it's not a vacation home. It's not. You have four types of suffering. Sufferings inflicted by our own body. The body gets sick. You step wrong, you twist your, sprain your ankle, and you have pain. And then your mind gives you trouble. Sometimes you're all healthy, but the mind is very turbulent, it's very, very naughty. Very always giving you some thoughts that are not very beneficial. Okay, what should I do now? Maybe I should yell at this person, or maybe I should criticize that person, maybe I should do this. You know, the mind is always there. And sometimes the mind remembers bad things that happened to us, and we suffer even in the present for something that happened a long time ago. Then you don't have to suffer for that, but the mind brings it back, and you suffer. So suffering from the body, suffering from your mind. And sometimes other people inflict suffering on you in different ways. Suffering from other people and from suffering from natural disturbances. Sometimes, you know, there's no heat in your house. There's some problem. So this inconvenience. Winter time, you have to call. You have to make phone call, report, and it takes time before it gets fixed. Your house, God forbid, gets burned down. And then you have a problem. You have to hope the insurance company will give you something so you can get a new house. There's always some suffering. Mother Nature, you know, tornadoes, flood, hunger, thirst, no rain. All this suffering. So this is certainly not a vacation home. And then I know sometimes people want to make this a vacation home, and I remember many times my patients at work, my clients who do exercise with me, they say, I can't wait till my vacation comes. I've been working so hard all this year, and I've been exercising a lot. Now it's time to go on vacation. I go to Hawaii, I go here, I go there. Dominican Republic, here and there, Florida, I'm going to enjoy, and the beach and this and that. So I said, oh, great, great. All right, I'll miss you here. So they go for 2 weeks, you know, they go and they do some different crazy things. And then many times they come back and they're actually suffering. They say, you know, I was trying to, you know, surf. I was trying to be, you know, do some water sports, and I fell and I twisted this and I cannot work out, you know, or I got sick, I got food poisoning. I tried this different exotic food and it didn't work for me. So they try to enjoy and have this vacation, and they had this mentality, but the result was different many times. They come back, even because they have this plane ride, you know, it's a sudden change of climates, temperatures and moisture and everything, and it's hard on their immune system, so they come back sick anyway. They have all congested, all coughing, and, you know, I say, so did you have a good time? Says, oh yeah, you know, but this happened and this, so it was okay. But then sometimes they are distracted from their workouts. They cannot work out because they got so sick after vacation, so you have to take another vacation from exercise. So you can see by simple examples how this place is not a vacation home, you know. Sooner or later something will happen, throw you off, and it's not going to feel that good. So we covered the four types of suffering that, you know, some people suffer a little bit more, some people suffer a little bit less. But the suffering by, you know, just virtue of being born, growing, and getting old and getting sick, and ultimately have to leave this body, it is very, very, very sad. It's not very pleasant. There is so much attachment, you know, so much attachment. I actually talked to my son yesterday too. So we just happened. He's like 7 years old. So we talked a little bit somehow about you know, spiritual life and how eventually, you know, we have to leave everything behind. So, you know, it was the way. You know, I'm not sure, I probably need some help from the devotees, like how to talk to younger devotees like that. But he said, but when we leave, when we go to Vrindavan, can I leave this skin as a souvenir? Can I still have it? And I said, well, you know, this is the nature of the body. You have a new body, you have a different body, you know. So it was really, I don't know how to answer exactly, because he's only 7 years old, but it was kind of I don't know, moving too, because they're trying to comprehend and think like, I have to leave this, and how am I going to exist? I need a new body. Okay, So it's pretty interesting, and we are all attached at different levels. It says in the Bhagavad Gita that we are born into delusion, bewildered by the dualities arisen from desire and hate. So from the very beginning, when you're born, you have this misconception that you are this body, and that it is you. But it's very hard to get rid of this misconception, and to really have no doubt that this is just a vehicle, you know, just like a car. Just trying to tell my son, this is just like I get in the car is moving, but if I get out of the car is useless without me. It's me. I am the mover, you know. So if you get out of the body is useless. It's just like a car standing, no gas, no driver. So, God is there, and He cares. He's like a good father. That's why He offers, the devotees are there in every age, and the scriptures come, so we can get educated and awaken ourselves from this slumber, thinking that, God is not there because I don't see Him. God doesn't care because we suffer. Good people suffer. Bad people, good people, everyone suffers. Sometimes even bad people don't suffer. They look happy. So it doesn't make sense. But there's a higher educational system in Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita that we can avail ourselves of, and go to the next level of understanding of where we're at. Higher educational system, quite different from what is offered in today's academics, today's academic field, schools you go, high school, college, graduate school. You may graduate the highest university, but like Srila Prabhupada said, if you still have this misconception that you are the body, and then you're meant to enjoy over here, it's a vacation home, then you don't really have your PhD, really. You're at level one, not even level one. So beyond this prison house, Krishna describes in the scriptures that there's our real home, and He's calling us by the presence of the devotees who are there to remind us, and the presence of the scriptures. We can read those scriptures nicely under supervision of our senior teachers. We can understand them properly. I remember when I was reading Bhagavad Gita first time, I couldn't understand the words, different foreign sounding words, but it kind of felt good to read it, but I couldn't understand what's being talked about, you know. The soul dies, the soul doesn't die, the body dies. I was confused, karma. But then fortunately I asked good questions and asked my Guru Maharaj and senior devotees how to understand these scriptures. So God is there and God cares. The last misconception that is there, that's kind of common, even among spiritualists, is that God is impersonal. God is impersonal. He's light. He's emptiness, energy. So if God is impersonal, okay, but how come you are a person? How is that? How did that happen? Can something impersonal create something personal? Your personality arise from light, from emptiness, from energy? But if the energy is personal, it's a supreme person, it's much easier, more reasonable to understand that we are also individual persons, because the supreme person is a person. Supreme energy is a person. So if God is omnipotent, He's complete, He can have two aspects. He can have the impersonal aspects, that's fine if you like that, and then He has His personal aspect. He's complete in that way. So if it's a matter of realization rather than, okay, this God is not a person, or He's just light, or He's a person but He's not really impersonal. It's just a matter of realization. And it's a matter of your desire, how you want to acknowledge that superior existence, superior energy. It's kind of logical, actually. It's your choice which aspect of God you choose, but however, it is much more pleasant to be. We have this tendency to live in a community, to live, you know, to interact with others. We have our individual talents and skills and likes and dislikes. We have our different unique qualities, each devotee, each person. You know, we like to interact and have relationships, whether they're successful or not. It's a tendency to be, you know, in a individual setting and have relationships. It's quite natural. It's very hard to destroy this type of existence, you know, like make everything empty without personality, just energy. So we can presume that it indicates a quality that's in our nature. It's quite natural to our being to be individuals. So we don't, it's unlikely that we will dissolve into nothingness when we leave this body. Why shouldn't there exist a spiritual world where our spiritual relationships grow? Like I mentioned in, I think, two classes ago, that these relationships that we have in this world are like training grounds. Training for the relationships that we will continue and have in the spiritual sky. I think in his books, Bhakti Tirtha Swami mentions that. He really puts stress on that, on relationships, and how these relationships, how you try to make the best out of them, reflect our desire to have perfect relationships with Krishna in the spiritual sky. We all be there, you know, interacting. It'll be just a continuation. In a perfect state, right now nothing is so perfect, but we are trying to make these relationships perfect. With Krishna in the center. So the spiritual sky, spiritual world exists, and we will continue to have our relationships there. I think I covered most of the points that I wanted to cover. Three misconceptions that are obstacles in accepting the supremacy of Krishna and trying to test him and put him in the back somewhere and doubt that Krishna is there. That the misconception is that God is not there, or he might be there but he doesn't care, or maybe God is not a person, just energy. Okay, and there are many more misconceptions, but I think this came to my mind. I think these are the major ones. In conclusion, I would like to say that Krishna tells us in Bhagavad Gita chapter 4 verse 42 that the doubts which have arisen in our hearts out of ignorance should be slashed by the weapon of transcendental knowledge. That's what Krishna tells Arjuna. And he teaches him how we're different from the body, how our main service is to perform duty for the Supreme God, for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and with devotion as much as we can. So the doubts which have arisen, the doubts that we talked about today, misconceptions, that are mostly present in those who are beyond, you know, those who are not necessarily devotees, but they're outside of our circles here, devotional circle. But also, we may have some thoughts and doubts that kind of like vestiges, like remains of some main misconceptions. So all of these should be slashed by being very fixed in the knowledge of the Shastra and trying to serve the instructions of our Guru. And when those doubts are cleared up and the intelligence is clear, then we can try to be concerned more about misconceptions that others have, and we'll be more capable of helping them once we don't have any doubts ourselves. And there are so many misconceptions, so we have a lot of work to do to make Srila Prabhupada happy. Thank you for your attention. Hope you have a great day in Krishna consciousness. If you have any questions, I will try to answer.
Hare Krishna Prabhu.
Hare Krishna.
Thanks for the class.
Sure.
You mentioned doubts. How do we clear up doubts or dissolve doubts? They seem to always there, the doubts. And Prabhu was saying the other day, so you have to dissolve all doubts, So I was thinking, I meant to ask Maharaj this. Yeah. How do you dissolve your doubts,
Could you give an example of like a doubt?
What kind of doubts?
Doubts you might have in yourself as far as trying to achieve something. Like not being able to write up to par or something like that, Or not being able to pass a test, Something like that.
Not being able to pass a test that Krishna gives us?
Something like that, or not being able to, to write up to par, write as good as you need to write in order to pass the test.
I see. I think it's a...
That's a doubt, I have a doubt.
Doubts within yourself, if you can really follow through with some service or follow the instructions or doubts about anything. Okay. Well, what works for me, because I have a lot of doubts myself, and they're coming every day. Every day they're coming at me, in the mind. But you can approach this question in different ways. But I always do better with deflecting those doubts. They'll be coming, They may be just thoughts, but if you let them inside, they will shake you, and then you won't be maybe able to perform your service properly. So the doubts will always be hovering, they're always here. But as much as you allow them deeper into your heart, then they can affect you. So usually what works for me when I have these thoughts, before they overwhelm me, I try to do the morning program and finish my morning program. When that is accomplished, I feel stronger to deflect the doubts. But still, sometimes you go throughout your day, go about your day, and still the doubts come. And then I think maybe you mentioned that in the other classes, we have to try to be surrendered and humble. And surrendered and humbled hour by hour, moment by moment. Sometimes you may finish your morning program, you feel great. 2-3 hours later, the positive spiritual energy fades away because there is so much material energy coming. We work in different environments. I'm not sure how different devotees work, but many of them work outside, and there's so much material energy that this the spiritual energy gets weaker, and sometimes we have doubts, and the thoughts come, different thoughts come, and they sometimes may get into the heart, and then we awaken our material desires again, because we let those thoughts in the heart. Now we're thinking, oh, I got these desires, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, my gosh. So as long as we catch those thoughts and doubts early, don't let them think, don't let them take a root. My Guru Maharaj would say that the thought comes about some doubt, I'm not able to do this, or oh, I have to get, do this, otherwise I won't survive without, you know, I don't know, chocolate or without this. You cut it right away. Cut it right away. Don't let it take root in your heart, because then it gets stronger, it gets amplified, and then it's a problem. And then you have to act on it. If it shakes you up, and then it's already deep within you. So moment by moment, if we stay surrendered and humble, and you can moment by moment, when the doubts are coming, you can be inside, internally, you can be praying and chanting. You could be offering prayers. You could be in this way trying to get surrendered to Krishna. And if you're surrendered, the doubts and humble, the doubts cannot penetrate deeper. Just like, I think, I'm not an expert on wrestling, but sometimes, you know, when you're in a stand-up, you know, you fight, you can be thrown, you know. But if you flat on the ground, they cannot throw you. You're very stable. So if you're on the ground, so if you're humble, you offer dandavats to Krishna, to devotees, you cannot fall down. But if you stand up, you're trying to come up with some interesting combinations and do different things, you can still be, you lose balance, they can throw you on the floor. But just a thought came to my mind. If you stand on the ground, very humble, they cannot throw you. You're stable, you know. Sure.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. Thank you for your wonderful class and your wonderful answer there at the end. Very beautiful answer that Krishna inspired you. I'm going to have to use that. Because if somebody's already fallen, like I appreciate your point, then if somebody already considers himself fallen, then how can, you know, they be thrown down? I'm already fallen. So that wrestling analogy, I really appreciate it. So my comment and question, please forgive me for not organizing my thoughts properly. Even my notes, I'm looking at them, they're pretty disorganized too, so please forgive me.
No problem.
But you were mentioning, the point that came to mind, you were mentioning in your class, is that Brahma tried to test Krishna, and then in the end, he admitted his defeat. And you were comparing that to our situation in life, generally speaking. I think you gave the example of Prabhupada. When Prabhupada approached Bhaktisiddhanta, I believe, he admitted his defeat. Am I correct? You mentioned that past time.
So.
And one thing that came to mind regarding that point is that in the material world, and I'll mention a couple of examples. In the material world, we see that if somebody in a debate between scholars, if somebody is the most profound speaker, who could quote the most verses, then they're generally considered the champion. People must admit their defeat. However, we hear the story, the famous story of Lord Chaitanya and the illiterate Brahmana.
Wow.
And the scholars were thinking the illiterate Brahmana should admit his defeat. We know more scriptures than him. He's illiterate, you know. We could defeat him. But Lord Chaitanya actually called the illiterate Brahmana an authority on the Gita and not the proud scholars, because the illiterate Brahma tried his best, whereas the scholars tried to be the best. And so we see basically that may be an obstacle in devotee relationships, because these proud scholars were thinking, I know more scriptures, I could speak more eloquently, therefore I'm the controller of the spotlight. But we see that's not the case all the time. We see that in Krishna consciousness, you may be in Krishna consciousness so long and you may know so many verses, but that does not mean people will glorify you. And they may glorify somebody else that's been in you know, who hasn't been in so long. And that's why in the Gita, Krishna says in chapter 10, verse 4 through 5, he says, fame, I am the controller of fame and infamy. And so sometimes when we chant the holy name, when we follow principles, we may think I deserve more glorification than others. I'm the controller of the spotlight. But one analogy I really appreciate is that we see that some Krishna is the controller of the sun. Like I said, in this verse it says Krishna is the controller of the spotlight, just like he's the controller of the sun. Now we see that the sun sometimes shines in our time zone, and the sun sometimes shines in someone else's time zone.
Right.
In much the same way, sometimes we receive some honor, the spotlight of honor, and sometimes someone else receives the spotlight of honor. So it doesn't matter how many rounds we chant, how many pujas we've done, that doesn't mean we're going to always be in the spotlight. Even if we're externally superior to somebody, somebody else may get the glorification. You can't force anyone to glorify you. People may glorify somebody else because, like Lord Chaitanya appreciated the Brahmana's humility, his character. And so, but we see that, how come we're not miserable when the sun leaves our time zone? In other words, why aren't we miserable when it's nighttime? Because we paid our light bill. In much the same way we read in the scriptures that if we pay the price of hearing teachings on how to remain enlightened with humility and appreciation, then we won't be engulfed by the darkness of pride and envy.
Wow.
There's a nice quote that says, in this regard, it says, people are like stained glass windows. They shine and sparkle when the sun is out, but when the darkness sets in, their true beauty is only revealed if there is a light from within.
Oh, wow. I really like it. That's nice.
And so we see that Prabhupada, in appreciation of Prabhupada was in the darkness for over 40 years before he received any sunlight, any spotlight, any honor. But why was he able to maintain his Krishna consciousness? Because he paid the price of always hearing teachings of how to remain humble, appreciative, forgiving, tolerant. And so one last point, there's many paths out there, one last point. So sometimes we may think, we hear in the scriptures that, I'll just give an example of Durvasa Muni and Ambarish. Durvasa Muni, he was also considered a great spiritualist. He paid the price. Just like sometimes we may say, if people are always hearing Krishna Katha, always chanting the holy name, always doing so many pujas, always around devotees, then why can't they maintain a Krishna consciousness? You know, they're hearing teachers on how to remain enlightened. So this is what Durvasa Muni did. He was a spiritualist. He was a renunciate. He gave in spiritual practices. But we see that if you pay your light company with real money, then your lights remain on. If you pay them with fake money, your lights will be turned off. In much the same way, when we do devotional activities with the right motivation, we remain happy. If we do it with the wrong motivation, then we remain unhappy. Krishna bhakta nishkama ata eva shan bhuti muti siddhi kami sakaliya shan. Lord Chaitanya says in this verse that a devotee, a Krishna bhakta, is always peaceful. Why? Because he pays the price with the right motivation. He's doing it for Krishna. And others are always disturbed because they're not doing it for Krishna. They're doing it for their own glorification. So my question is it's actually regarding a similar point, so maybe you could expand on it. You were mentioning that suffering is very subjective. For you, giving the class was suffering. And for some people, giving class is not suffering. They love it. And so we see that, like I will mention to you in your last class, God told Moses, I want you to go in the spotlight, release the Israelites from the entrapment. So sometimes we think, you know, if we want the spotlight, if we go in the spotlight, then that's pride. But we see that Moses or Arjuna refused the spotlight not out of humility but out of fear. And so sometimes humility for a person who loves the spotlight is going behind the scenes, whereas humility for somebody who doesn't like the spotlight, not out of humility but out of fear, is going into the spotlight. We see this. So my question is what are some steps we could take to be inclined to the the unorthodox form of humility, meaning when we're shy, when we don't like to give a public speech, how can we, what are some steps we could do to move into the spotlight? Because we may say, we may make excuses for ourselves. Oh, I'm not going in the spotlight because I don't want to be proud. But internally, the Lord knows that I'm not a very good speaker. I'm not very eloquent. So what are some steps we could do to not make excuses for ourselves? Go into the spot. Even if we are proud, Christian will humble us. He's the controller. But what are some steps we could do to advance our Christian conscience? But because we see that a seed cannot grow without going outside its comfort zone, without being buried in the ground. In much the same way, we see that we can't grow in our spiritual life when we're not, when we don't go outside our comfort zone, you know. And that means going to the spotlight. If, like you said, your guru told you to go in the spotlight, go outside your comfort zone, then you could grow. So what are some steps we could take to develop the unorthodox form of humility, which means going into the spotlight when our guru, our teacher, or somebody encourages us and not make excuses for ourselves, you know, disguise as humility. So maybe you could expand on some of those.
Thank you, Prabhu. Very good point, you know. I have a very difficult time, you know, accepting that instruction and, you know, something going out of my comfort zone, you know, and how I try to serve. What works for me is the sense of duty, you know. You may not like this, you may not like that. I explain to myself that sometimes, you know, there's so many things that are good, but we don't feel like doing them because we want to stay in our comfort zone, you know. Going to school, you know, brushing our teeth. You just, you know, eat some good meal and you feel like, I want to go to sleep now. You don't want to brush your teeth. It feels good in the mouth, you know, it's nice. But there's so many good things that we know are good, but the fact that we are attached to our comfort zone makes us forget or disregard those duties or instructions. So when I was, strongly suggested by my Guru Maharaj that I should do this, it made it easier for me to understand a sense of duty. You need to force yourself a little bit, and you can look at your life. Look at your life. You know what you accomplished. You know, like as far as you know, we all have different lives, but things like it can be, you know, that you accomplished over the years. And you can always understand that it is many times you didn't feel like doing certain things, but because you did those things, that's where you got. You got to that point, school or job, promotion, you know. So similarly in spiritual life, there should be an incentive. Even if a sense of duty is not enough sometimes, many practicing devotees may not feel, you know, strong love for Krishna, you know, the prema is not really there yet, and maybe the taste sometimes is overshadowed, so we have to rely on the sense of duty when the taste is not so strong yet to follow through with some things. So the sense of duty can help, and you can understand that there's so many good things that come from fulfilling your duties, you know, the duty to your teachers to follow their instructions. This way, Bhagavad Gita explains that in the beginning, some things may feel like poison, you know, but at the end, they feel great. So usually things that are in goodness, things, duties and works that are in goodness require some austerity, some pain, just because we are conditioned. If we were not conditioned, it would not be difficult. But if you appeal to the sense of duty and you understand that, oh, after I go through this initial feeling of being uncomfortable and suffering, mental or physical, I will actually please my teacher, I will please my family, please my God brothers, God sisters, and ultimately Krishna. So you can appeal to this, you can understand it, because human beings have this ability. to predict, you know, if I follow this, even though it's not so good, I will feel better, you know, a week from now, or a month from now, a year from now, or even in a few hours. So because we can go into the future and look and assess and predict, we can say, okay, if I do this, it's not very comfortable, I will make those around me happy, and I will make Krishna happy and ultimately myself. I think that helps the sense of duty and being able to confirm with the scriptures that yes, it's not comfortable, but if it's done, it'll feel good. It'll have like a beneficial effect on everyone, not only just myself. I hope this helped a little bit.
Appreciate your last point. If what was your last point? If we do it, something like that.
Sure.
Yeah, I appreciate that point. That just brought to mind that your father, your husband, and if you pay your bills, you not only benefit yourself, you benefit your family.
I like it.
They won't like you. They won't like you. In much the same way, you know, if we pay the price of the hearing these teachings, then we're going to remain happy, and we'll also make other people happy. Mm-hmm. You know, our spiritual family. So anyway, yes. That came to mind. Thank you.
I like it. Thank you.
All right.
It's a little late, but I wanted to ask something. You were presenting three misconceptions that could be there regarding the existence of God. So one of the misconceptions you were looking at was that people have a sense of suffering, and because of suffering there's the implication that there cannot be a God existing that's permitting suffering to go on. So the logic you used was that suffering is subjective. So if suffering is subjective, it means that happiness is also subjective. So it means suffering can be changed on one's own, because one changes concepts or controls one's thinking. So I'm not really quite clear how the logic goes that just because of that fact that God still exists, because that was the logic you were using. So I'm not quite clear how it implies that God exists just because of the subjectivity of happiness or unhappiness or suffering.
It's a very good question. Very, very good. I was using this like a supplemental argument. Some people say that, if good things happen to bad things happen to good people, then it's not fair. That means God doesn't care. So, but I think I was using it as like a secondary, supplemental argument, not the main argument. That, you know, happiness and suffering is subjective, based on our desires. Because we are able to create our own. We are minutely independent, so we have our own desires. And Krishna gives us that free will. You desire whatever you like. So because of these desires, we create our expectations and plans. And based on that, we perceive happiness and distress. But there may not be a direct link between the argument. That's okay. I was just using it to sometimes you can just say like a little supplemental argument that some people may kind of like yeah, right, suffering is subjective. That means if I don't want to suffer, what do I have to do not to suffer? And then you can give them some extra instructions, like, okay, if you don't want to suffer in your body, do this. If you don't want to experience suffering in your mind, then do this. And then they can maybe take your instructions to maybe adopt a healthier lifestyle. And then they build faith in what you have to offer them, you know, instructions on how to take care of the body, instructions on how to take care of the mind. And then they may be in a good position to ask you questions about spiritual life. You know, so it's a supplemental argument, but it doesn't have to be used. Just maybe leading up to another argument. Mm. Sorry to confuse you. Okay, sure. My logic not so great sometimes. Okay, any other questions? Shri Prabhupada ki jai.